This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, part two of America's opioid crisis. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. We pick up where we left off from last week's conversation about America's deadliest drug crisis ever. After tackling the primary causes and the scope of the opioid epidemic in part one, on this edition of the program, we'll address treatment, prevention, and the role of government with our special guests, senior VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins, as well as Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, and Dr. Wilson Compton, deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. All panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me turn first to Dr. Caleb Alexander. You talked about in part one, you know, the need for alternative treatments, alternatives to chronic pain for which opioids should not perhaps have ever been prescribed to begin with. So let me ask you about how much progress is being made in terms of transitioning from prescribing opioids to other types of interventions, whether it be physical therapy or ibuprofen. How much progress are we making here in America?
As we spoke about last week, this epidemic has been getting worse, in some cases hidden in plain sight for 20 years. And it's going to take a while for us to turn this steamship around. In fact, most experts predict that the number of injuries and deaths from opioids is going to increase further still in the years to come rather than decline. There are a number of ways, however, that we can promote safer and more effective alternatives to opioids. A big one is through provider and patient education. And one of the fortunate points that we've reached is one of public awareness. It would be hard to find a stakeholder that isn't aware of this epidemic and concerned about it. And one of the benefits of this means that it's easier to reach and to disseminate information about the many safer and more effective alternatives to opioids for chronic non-cancer pain. And there's a tremendous amount of interest these days in better understanding how coverage policies, that is, how the costs of alternatives to opioids, both prescription drugs and especially non-prescription drugs, compare to that of opioids, because economic incentives matter. And if you make opioids more expensive relative to alternatives that are safer and more effective, we're going to see continued transitions to these alternative products.
That's been a key question for the field, is people want access to non-opioid treatments, but that may not be covered as well by their insurance policies. Dr. Alexander is actually doing a study right now in partnership with us and others in the federal government to look at this question so that doctors want to prescribe physical therapy, chiropractic, acupuncture, other approaches for treatment of pain. Will that be covered by insurance? How will it be paid by patients? This is a key question and one that can drive these changes, and we need to know more about it.
How will changes to the Affordable Health Care Act affect opioid addiction treatment?
It's a great question, and there's certainly been tremendous interest in how the Affordable Care Act has helped to increase the accessibility and the quality of treatment for opioid use disorders among the U.S. population. Some of the main concerns and pushback that was voiced against efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act recently were based on concerns about the potential impact of removing Medicaid insurance for tens of millions of Americans who rely on this for treatment to addiction services. There are huge gaps and huge shortcomings in our ability to provide addiction treatment services for everyone that needs it. But there certainly has been a lot of concern about the way that the changes to the Affordable Care Act may impact these services.
I'd like to point out that no matter what your political persuasions, almost everyone seems to agree that we need to do a better job of providing treatment to those who have an addictive disorder. So there's been general agreement that we need to make sure that our system can get people into treatment and keep them in quality care. No matter what, we haven't been seeing that. Up to date, we have people who don't have access to care under the current system, and so we're looking for ways across the federal government and state governments and even through private payers to increase access to high-quality care. That's a shared goal for all of us.
Yeah, it has been remarkable, the amount of bipartisan interest and support in this. And I think it's because there's no corner of the country that hasn't been touched by this epidemic. Every place that I go to talk about opioids, someone in the audience identifies afterwards as having experienced a personal loss related to these products. And so it truly is an area where I think there's broad bipartisan support to improve the access and quality of addiction treatment services in the United States.
Okay, gentlemen, but I hear you speaking about two issues, separate but related. One, treatment of those addicted to opioids, and we need to make sure that they get into proper treatment, but also the necessity of having insurance, and this relates to healthcare policy and either the renewal but modification of so-called Obamacare or a new health plan, for which insurance will cover non-opioid pain medication more readily. What do you say to that, Dr. Compton?
Well, I think that's a key question. Do patients have access to the non-opioid treatments for pain? And that's what Dr. Alexander's study is all about right now, to make sure that the private insurers, that Medicare, that Medicaid, that the different systems that people use in the United States for access to health care does provide the ability to get these non-opioid treatments.
And I'd like to ask my colleague Chris Simpkins a question about your observations on your travels. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, now I may be wrong, but the rural areas that you travel to, mm-hmm. they're the ones with the least types of health centers that provide these alternatives, that these areas are the quickest to resort to opioids for pain. Is that correct? And do you think that, therefore, a shortcoming is that we need to do a better job in rural America and other areas of creating preventative centers or better medical facilities, or let's call it healthcare facilities, where people can go and talk about their pain and where it originates and then be prescribed physical therapy or other non-opioid types of medications?
You're absolutely right. As we travel throughout the country in rural areas, we saw that they do not have the treatment facilities they need right now to handle this, even in big cities like Miami. But I think what is going on is that people see that there is this need, but there is a hard time in any community, whether you're small or large, to build new treatment facilities for these patients to go in and stay for 90 days. So because of the difficulties in getting these inpatient treatment centers built and being able to help people, that we'd have to look more, and the experts have told me, to outpatient alternatives for treatment, because we just cannot expand on our treatment centers.
And also, I'm asking about somebody in Appalachia or any other part of the country that is suffering from this crisis.
Well, it is an important issue. And keep in mind that if you have addiction to opioid, it's like having alcoholism. This is a chronic disease. Now, not everybody that uses opioids long-term develops addiction, so that's important for people to keep in mind. But of the subset who do, this is a chronic condition. It's like diabetes or high blood pressure. The individual has a lifelong vulnerability to opioid products. And so this isn't the type of illness or disease that one is simply treated for a month or two, and then you're off and on your way. These are individuals that need ongoing, comprehensive, high-quality care for their condition, just as someone does that has heart disease or hypertension and the like. And I think that one of the huge challenges that we're facing right now as a health system and as a society is figuring out how to optimally integrate the care of patients with opioid use disorders with the primary care that they need, because these individuals, just as others with chronic diseases, also need primary care. Some of them have hepatitis C, some have HIV. There are high rates of other chronic diseases within this population, to say nothing of the fact that many of them have chronic pain, which was how they got the opioid addiction in the first place. And so there are huge challenges that we face. And one other point I'd like to make is just that the majority of individuals with opioid use disorders have not been even diagnosed. So there's the first step, which is better identifying and reaching out to those with opioid use disorders. And then the second step, which is building and designing these care systems that will better be able to deliver comprehensive, longitudinal care for their opioid use disorders in the context of high-quality healthcare.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Chris Simpkins, senior VOA correspondent. Our guests on this second installment of the show are Dr. Caleb Alexander. He's co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, and Dr. Wilson Compton, deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. We're continuing our discussion of the opioid epidemic in America. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Ong Min Tu from Myanmar. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. And we'd also like to know what you think of VOA's Encounter, and we'd appreciate it if you took a brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielloVOA. Dr. Compton, I'd like you to weigh in on this issue of helping opioid users to recover, so treatment centers, but also better health care here in this country, particularly where we have shortcomings in the rural areas.
I think it's remarkable how difficult it is to provide services in rural area and how little attention this has gotten. We saw this extraordinarily demonstrated in Indiana when we detected an outbreak of HIV in southern Indiana in a rural county about an hour and a half north of Louisville, Kentucky, where there was an epidemic of HIV spread in a group that were sharing syringes for their use of oxymorphone, injecting a prescription medication. There was virtually no medical facilities in that county. So one of the key issues was there was no public health infrastructure. There was nobody doing outreach to the population, teaching them how to keep themselves safe, let alone offering drug treatment or things like syringe access to provide access to sterile syringes so that they might at least avoid spreading infectious diseases. I'm pleased that the National Institute on Drug Abuse has recently funded a series of studies in rural areas around the country to look at different ways to organize healthcare so that we can address the opioid crisis, whether that's in New England, in Appalachia, in North Carolina, in Ohio, in New Mexico, even in Oregon and Wisconsin. We have studies just launched to develop new models of care for effectively reaching these devastated rural populations.
Dr. Compton, as you know, President Trump and his administration are drafting documents that would formally declare a state of emergency for the opioid crisis. What can that bring to bear, a declaration of state of emergency, to helping with the crisis?
Well, we saw this being recommended by the Opioid Commission chaired by Governor Chris Christie. And I think one of the key goals of this declaration is to really continue to bring public attention to this serious crisis, to make sure that we have a situation where it's all hands on deck so that everyone is contributing, whether that's the private sector in terms of private insurance, making sure that they don't have policies or practices that prevent people from getting the treatments that they need that could help save their lives, whether it's law enforcement and first responders being equipped with naloxone to save lives when they detect somebody who's overdosed, or whether it's making sure that we have better access to treatment by reducing some of the policy barriers that keep people from getting treated. That might be some of the ways that emergency declaration could help us.
How do you see it, Dr. Caleb Alexander, in terms of the declaration of a national emergency? How could that help?
Well, I think it's been met with a lot of enthusiasm and relief by many in the clinical and advocacy communities for just the reasons that Dr. Compton mentioned. There also has been some concern expressed that such a declaration might also allow for and lead to a greater reliance on law enforcement methods, for example, as a means to try to deter the use of prescription opioids and heroin and fentanyl. And I don't think that we can arrest our way out of this epidemic, but I do think that the balance of efforts on reducing prescription opioid prescribing and improving access to treatment on the one hand and focusing on law enforcement on the other is going to be very important to discuss as a community and as a society and to reach consensus on.
How important, Dr. Compton, do you think would be even more severe crackdown on criminal suppliers and dealers?
One of the areas where we haven't figured out how to solve the problem is access to fentanyl. Fentanyl is, for the most part, produced in laboratories and chemical factories in China and then shipped using the postal service or commercial carriers directly to the U.S. or to Canada and Mexico, and then comes across the border like other illegal drugs. So it's really part of the illegal drug trade. But unfortunately, it's so incredibly potent that very small quantities can be sold on the street for vast sums of money. And really, that's what's driving this. There was a wonderful article in the Wall Street Journal about the business of fentanyl sales, where something like $1,000 worth of precursor or fentanyl products themselves can be sold on the street in the U.S. for around $1 million. That's a phenomenal profit margin that really drives the behavior. So I hope we can find ways for law enforcement to help reduce the access through commercial carriers and through the Postal Service. That will be one way that we might help keep our streets a little bit safer. At the same time, we aren't going to arrest our way out of this problem. And so we need to make sure that when people do come in touch with law enforcement, that they are linked effectively with care. That's been a goal of research and of practice, is to make sure that those who are arrested, those who are in jail, and those who are in prison have access to effective, quality, evidence-based treatments.
And we saw that as we traveled around the country. We focused on drug courts, and more people coming into these drug courts are addicted to opioids. And what these drug courts are doing and the positive aspects of them are diverting people away from jail with severe addictions. And so these people are put into treatment facilities. They're able to stay in a program for a year. If they complete that program, their felony drug charges are dropped, and we've had great success in seeing their addictions have been beaten and they've been able to be sober and go on and to live a productive life. But a part of that treatment that so many claim is vital in these drug courts is to give them medication that will reduce their anxiety. Give them medication like Suboxone, which will block their high, and an ability to get them sober. So having someone addicted to opioids in a jail is not going to be the answer from those people who are running these drug courts. And they do show promise from what we have seen.
I think the drug courts play a very valuable role, and there's tremendous interest in them. I'm also reminded of innovative strategies to enroll patients in medication-assisted treatment, that is, treatment for their opioid use disorder, at the time that they have an encounter with the healthcare system, having experienced an overdose. About a year or two ago, there was a remarkable paper published that suggested that more than 9 out of 10 patients experiencing an overdose that come into a hospital or an emergency department go on to receive further prescription opioids from the health system. And that's a remarkable and stunning statistic. And I think it highlights and underscores the challenges that we face, but also the opportunities that we face to reach patients at times where they're in need, where they're vulnerable, where they're in pain, where they're experiencing some of the consequences that we see all too often from an addiction such as an opioid use disorder, and to assist them with accessing the care that they need.
So, Dr. Compton, as you said earlier, we do need a holistic approach. We need to treat those who are addicted to opioids. We need to prevent people who are not addicted from taking them and perhaps using alternative methods. But what do you think is the role of drug companies, pharmaceuticals? Some people think that we should hold them accountable and that they have a role in perpetuating the use of opioids. They're making profits from it. How do you see their role in stopping this addiction, in helping to prevent the expansion of this epidemic?
Well, I do think we need to partner with the pharmaceutical industry to develop new pain medications that are less addictive, less habit-forming. That, after all, might be a major, useful, transformative solution. We also need to work with the pharmaceutical industry to get better treatments for addiction itself. I'm very pleased with the 3 medications we have now, but not everybody responds to them. And so we need to have better medications that can reach a larger percentage of our patients. I will say that, as Dr. Alexander was talking about, the healthcare system can respond more effectively. Not only can they stop prescribing opioids to those that are showing problems from them, But we saw a wonderful study where an emergency department in New Haven, under the leadership of Dr. Gail D'Onofrio and colleagues, started prescribing buprenorphine. That's one of the medications that's used to treat an opioid use disorder. They started prescribing this medications to patients that came to the emergency room. So instead of just referring them out to a clinic, sending them down the street to somebody's clinic, they started them on the life-saving medication right then and there in the emergency room. This is the kind of promising study that the National Institute on Drug Abuse supports, and we're now doing a multi-site trial to see if this can be generalized to other emergency rooms and other facilities around the United States so that we can treat patients where they're showing up.
Well, Dr. Alexander, I'd like you to weigh in on this type of holistic approach, not just stopping illegal supply, trying to reduce the prescription of these opioids, but also prevention. And what about the role of pharmaceuticals in terms of producing fewer types of addictive drugs? How can they or should they be held accountable for this crisis?
Well, I'll leave it to the courts to decide whether or not they should be held accountable and to what degree. But I will say there is interest and there are plenty of large litigations going on that some have compared to the tobacco settlements of a few decades ago. You know, I think the question about the role of pharmaceutical companies is a complex one because these products are important and no product is inherently good or bad, harmful or helpful. It depends upon the context in which the product is used. And for patients at the end of life or those with severe pain or advanced cancer pain, opioids are perfectly reasonable and maybe best practice. But the challenge that we face is that they've been used all too often for chronic non-cancer pain in settings with an unfavorable risk-benefit balance. And the last point I'd like to make about pharmaceutical companies has to do with a new group of products called abuse deterrent formulations, or ADFs. There's enormous interest in these formulations on the part of pharmaceutical companies. These include products, for example, that are designed to be harder to crush or harder to melt so that it makes it more difficult to inject. And I think that there's been a lot of enthusiasm on the part of these products, but also a lot of hype. And so I think it's important that we closely scrutinize and evaluate the impact that these products have on the outcomes that matter. That is, the number of Americans that are being injured or killed by prescription opioids.
So, Dr. Compton, your thoughts with respect to going forward, whether it's education, more individual responsibility, more responsibility on the part of all the actors, what would you say is the best path forward?
This is a very complex situation, and like other complex conditions in complex areas, we need everyone to play a role. There's certainly a role based on how our Department of Health and Human Services has laid out priorities in terms of new research to produce transformative approaches to this problem, better access to data as a simple way to help guide the implementation of policy and practices, making sure that we engage in prevention, whether that's better education for doctors, but also access to treatment and recovery services. So we want to save lives acutely so we can help people get into recovery in the long run.
And Chris, turning to you for the last word regarding, again, your observations and the role of education, individual responsibility. Did you get a sense from the people you spoke with that, you know, they have a stake in this and that they're not just bystanders or victims, but also other people in the community would like to see a better healthcare system that would not necessarily make them rely on these types of addictive drugs?
That's what it's all about, raising public awareness, getting the community invested to tackle this problem and beat back this opioid crisis. Everywhere I went, that is what I heard. And until people come out and start talking about it, talking about the family stigma issue and how much families go through with pain, emotional pain, financial stress when a loved one is addicted, it just doesn't affect that one person. It affects the whole family. And my concern is unless we stand up and do something about this, we are going to continue to see these overdose opioid drug deaths rise. And what it's doing, Carol, it's taking people out of the community. So it's going to be individuals in that community standing up as one to solve this epidemic.
And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my co-host, senior VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins, along with our special guests, Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, and Dr. Wilson Compton, deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. Gentlemen, thanks so much for devoting so much of your time and expertise in helping us understand the scope of the opioid crisis in America. And also a special thanks to Chris Simpkins for joining us. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Pete Hundley. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.